Well, it's a privilege to follow Dr. Kurtzman. I've certainly followed his work in the literature, and he's really been a leader at examining the science behind organic production. So I'll be talking about managing phosphorus for organic growers. You may have known us as the Potash and Phosphate Institute. We're now the International Plant Nutrition Institute. And for a long time, we've sort of had a history of sort of a struggle with how do we incorporate or embrace the ideals of organic agriculture. And so at this point, we're saying you decide if you want to use organic production techniques or not. We're here to help you with the best science possible. So it's a philosophical thing often, and so we won't argue about that right now, but we'll talk about phosphorus management. So IPNI is exciting. It's a new nonprofit organization. We just started in 2007, related to all kinds of nutrient management. So on our website, we have information such as I'll show you today, as well as on lots of other things related to nutrient management. Just to start off, why do we put phosphorus on? Well, if you want to be able to harvest something, you have to have something in the soil to begin with. Doesn't matter if it's conventional farming, if it's organic farming. You can pick some crops. I just put a few examples up here. You have to have nutrients in the soil if you want to harvest things. So is phosphorus fertility different somehow if you're using organic techniques? Is the chemistry different? Is the nutrition different? Are the processes different? Well, organically grown crops still need phosphorus. We think we can all agree on that. But the soil properties in an organic production system may be different. We heard about large inputs of carbon, for example. And that may affect the nutrient cycling in that system. And often we hear about a mycorrhizal fungi growing in organic systems. Also, that can perhaps change phosphorus availability. So there could be some differences, but primarily the systems, the chemistry should be fairly similar. A lot of these comments today are based on a workshop that we had at the horticulture meetings last year, and the set of papers was just published this last month that might be a good reference for you if you're interested in more information on this. We started off with a nice talk by Carl Rosen, Exploring the Benefits of Organic Nutrient Sources, a real good literature review based on that. And Mark Gaskell from California talked about nitrogen sources. Nathan Nelson from Kansas State University talked about phosphorus sources, and I followed up with potassium. Potassium is the easiest one, so I think I lucked out on this set of papers that we put together that's now available at Hort Technology. So it's a nice sort of state-of-the-art literature review of these different nutrients. So if you're at the horticulture meeting, I apologize. Some of this may be a bit of a repeat. So today we're going to talk about some inorganic phosphorus sources, bone meal and rock phosphate, some organically-based, carbon-based sources, green manures and animal manures, and also some compost as phosphorus sources in organic systems. People say, well, why do farmers use all this fertilizer anyway? Well, I have this old slide that I like to show sometimes. It wasn't hard to convince farmers which side of that picture they wanted to be on. Where there was P and K added on the left and no fertilizer, the traditional techniques, which included using animal manure and green manures, whatever they had available on the right-hand side. You can see the dramatic response when phosphorus and potassium was added to the corn crop here. So let's talk about bone meal. If you can identify that picture on the far left, that's a dinosaur bone. I wonder how long that's been there. A long time. Guess what happens to bones in the soil? They last a long time. That buffalo skull, it's been there a long time, I don't know exactly, but bone meal is not a great source of phosphorus in many conditions because it's very insoluble. We'll talk about some of the chemistry of that. So people don't think about bone meal so much. Well, you have a skeleton on one side and you have bone meal on the other, right? That's where bone meal comes from, hydroxyapatite primarily. So people have been using bone meal, and then they figured out if you grind these bones up and treat them with sulfuric acid, we have the first commercial fertilizer, which was single superphosphate. You see some of these ads for the old fertilizers, and it's just, can you imagine a fertilizer label like that now? You know, this bloody skull with a dripping heart of blood coming out of it. But that was a demonstration that this was the good stuff. No, the process for forming apatite, sulfuric acid to form single superphosphate. Here's another ad that I really like. This is made from mastodon bones, right? Well, I don't know about that, but some of the people realize that when you treat bones with acid, you have a completely different nutrient source than when you add bones by themselves. And the chemistry has not changed. We laugh at some of these ads, but the chemistry is still the same. So we see some of these bone meals available, and we'll talk about the chemistry and the dissolution in just a minute. I wonder about, look at some of these fertilizer analysis on these bags. That first one, 1200. See, now, did they get the numbers mixed up on that somewhere? I'm not quite sure. And the bone meal on the right, it's 0.15, 15, and then it's supposed to have a potassium number on there too, I think, somewhere. But, and again, I put a picture of, again, another dinosaur bone in the bottom left-hand corner there that has been there for a long time. In many soils, bones are very stable. So if you're looking for a rapid phosphorus response, bone meal is generally not a good way to provide it. That's just chemistry in action. Let's talk about rock phosphate quickly. This is from a North American perspective, so I apologize to those that are not from North America. This was first discovered and developed in North Carolina a long time ago, 1867. Looks like a fun job, doesn't it? And after the Civil War, they dug this stuff up by hand, they put it in barges and shipped it all over. And then they learned to acidulate it, and you know, so that was a source of phosphorus in most of North America. I guess in the 1890s, they discovered that there were huge phosphorus resources in Florida. And that's when the commercial fertilizer industry really started getting to go in North America. Universities got all excited. There's one from Maryland, one from Tennessee. Said, this phosphorus stuff is great, we're doing wonderful things. And the fertilizer industry started, the Superphosphate Institute began. Showing that roots are stimulated, lots of things were happening. People were very excited about phosphorus. So rock phosphate is a phosphorus source. It comes, it's a slowly soluble phosphorus source, mined calcium phosphates. This is a picture from North Carolina. But its solubility is dependent on lots of sources, whether it's going to work or not. Depending on the soil type, and low pH is the most important factor. Generally, you want pH 5 or below for rock phosphate to dissolve. You think, well, pH 5, there's some other problems that start to occur, right? Like low calcium or high aluminum, you might get some toxicity there. And the dissolution also depends on the phosphorus fixation capacity of the soil and the organic carbon content of the soil. All these things come together to determine how fast rock phosphate will dissolve. Also, the rock phosphate source is very important. It can range dramatically from rock phosphate sources throughout the world. But using a 2% citric acid extract is a good way to predict what the solubility will be as an index of availability. And just remember, if you buy rock phosphate, there's many different sources. Some are good sources of phosphorus, some are very poor sources of phosphorus. It'll be about as effective as putting gravel in the soil. You know, if your soil pH is high or you have an insoluble phosphorus source. And the particle size needs to be very small, so you have high reactivity. Just quickly, we started off in South Carolina, developed our phosphorus reserves in Florida, Tennessee, Idaho, Utah, North Carolina was a latecomer, and we have some up in the prairie states too. But most of our phosphorus comes from Florida and California now. So what happens to rock phosphate? When is this going to work in the soil and when may it not? Well, again, I just put this reaction up there because it's essential to see that you have to have acidity to dissolve rock phosphate to turn it into soluble phosphate. If you don't have acidity there, it's not going to work. I work in California, and people are wanting to use rock phosphate in organic production systems. And they say, you know, it's a nice idea some places, but it's not going to work for our situation very well. It works great in some tropical situations and in acid soils. You have to have that acidity present. You've all seen these diagrams from Muller-Lindsay a number of years ago. So we have fluoroapatite, which is the rock phosphate, and hydroxyapatite, which is similar to the bone phosphorus. And we know that as the pH goes down, we start to have dissolution occurring, but it only is available at low pHs. When you get to the low pH, however, all of a sudden we have problems with aluminum and iron and other and chemical reactions that make the phosphorus less soluble. A lot of approved rock phosphate sources, however, this is from the OMRI list, which approves, sort of keeps a catalog of what's allowed in organic production. None of these products tell you what their solubility is. They just say, there's phosphorus there, trust me, it'll do you some good. And there's great differences in those sources and their availability. So we really need to know more about this rock phosphate than just the total P content. How about green manures? Those are a great source of phosphorus, right? Well, you know, green manures, they're typically legumes that are grown, tilled into the soil. And some cover crops are very good at extracting phosphorus that's not available to the primary target crop. For example, white lupin is very good. Fava beans and this nitro alfalfa are very good at extracting phosphorus to lower concentrations than crops can. So then you kill that cover crop, the decomposition releases that phosphorus, right, and makes it available for the next crop. So it can be a good idea, but green manures can increase some phosphorus availability, but they don't provide any new phosphorus. So again, we're running the system down. If you don't start at a high level, you have to have some inputs periodically to keep that phosphorus available for the next crops. Manures and composts, again, a great source. And I really appreciated Dr. Kirchman saying, well, really, we're just transporting phosphorus from one farm to another farm. So that's not a new source of phosphorus necessarily, and you may artificially give that credit. But those are used widely for organic production. Obviously, you can't use raw manures according to organic certification directly on food crops. They have to either sit for a while, we have to put the manure on in advance of the planting, but it can be a good source. There's all kinds of manures out there. This is one of my favorites. Cricket crab, $5 for a 4-pound box, but you know. But you've seen these manures too, the guanos and all kinds of things. You know, these are sort of specialty products. We're generally thinking more of the dairy manures and the poultry manures that can be a good source. What are some of the limitations of manure, however? Again, it's not a new nutrient source. You're just transporting it from one farm to another. Let's look at the form of phosphorus in manures. Generally, these are some averages gathered from the literature. But in feedlot manure, about 75% of it is as inorganic phosphorus. And you can go down. Most of phosphorus in organic manures is present, very similar to conventional fertilizers. There is a fraction that is present as organic phosphorus that will require some mineralization, however. So one of the problems, as you are very well aware, we had a whole session about it yesterday, is these imbalances that are caused with soil nutrients when you use manure and compost as a nitrogen supply. I just use corn as an example here. This would be the relative corn crop requirement compared to available nutrients in dairy manure. So if you put on enough nitrogen to boost this up to this level, you're also putting on 2 or 3 times more phosphorus than the plant requires. So that's a well-documented fact on organic farms that when you use compost and manures as a nitrogen source, the phosphorus source gets very high. And we've published on some of those issues before. So the balance isn't quite right. Generally, there's a nice study done by Sikora et al. In the Agronomy Journal a few years back. They looked at poultry that are compost, compared that with triple superphosphate to come up with some availability coefficients. And they say generally, availability ranges from 70 to 100%, which is what I just showed you in terms of organic and inorganic phosphorus forms. So we use an availability coefficient of 70% for soils that are low in P, and use 100% availability for soils that have high phosphorus in them. Mycorrhizal fungi, you're all familiar with what those things are. Those can be very beneficial, but again, they don't provide any new phosphorus to the system. And Laura's giving me that scowl, I recognize. So the mycorrhizal fungi allow phosphorus to be extracted to a lower concentration, but doesn't provide new phosphorus. So again, that's not a great way to manage phosphorus organically. We need to be careful about excessive phosphorus. We're familiar with the water quality problems, and a lot of papers are being presented this week about that. So we want to use best management practices in any situation where we're adding nutrients, especially with phosphorus. That may include no-till or cover crops. However, with no-till, we leave the manure on the surface, and that's more prone to washing off during rainfall events. So that's sort of a mixed blessing grass buffer strips, and often we want to incorporate the manure or compost prior to rainfall. You know, it reduces some of those interactions with the runoff and reduces phosphorus being lost in the tail water. So summary, use rock phosphate in acid soils only, bone meal also in acidic soils. Organic phosphorus sources can be excellent sources of phosphorus, 70 to 100% compared to conventional and soluble fertilizers. And composted manures behave very similarly to that. We want to use best management practices and reduce erosion and losses whenever we're using any nutrient source. So we have a lot of information on our website, ipni.net, related to nutrient management, conventional as well as organic. So I encourage you to go there and look at some of those things. So we're all, I hope we'll be finished. Thank you.